This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
So, for those of you who are have just joined us, we started in the fall. Our fall Angus theme was the Eightfold Path, and as part of that, we've been meeting and having these mandos on each of the aspects of the Eightfold Path, and so which extended beyond the fall, obviously, and so now we're into our last two, this one being right mindfulness. And I was thinking about, as I was working on this, I was sort of thinking of a symphony that is has introduced all of these themes and is building and building and building up to its but that's not quite accurate. Although it's dramatic in it. Made me feel good. Because, and it's important that it's not accurate in that, in how intimate and codependent and necessarily joined all of these aspects are. Perhaps it's one of the dangers of presenting the Eightfold Path is that we can divide it up into eight pieces. And in that, it's sort of like a buffet. I'll take two of those and one of those. I don't need those over there. And then there's the inevitable sense of, well, what comes first and what comes last and how are they ranked and what's more important and what should I really be concentrating on? And that would be a mistake. Because what makes this path so profound and so powerful is that it is an eightfold path that is really one path, that it is various doorways or practices, points of emphasis, perspectives, ways of working with our body and our mind that are powerful because they give us different perspectives and doorways. And so when we focus on right understanding, we are really concentrating on understanding. When we study right intention, we're really studying the nature of intention and thought and the importance of that and why is it important? How is it important in our mind and in our consciousness and so on through all of them? And so it allows us to really dedicate attention and hone in and, in a sense, go deeply into that one aspect. But then as we move forward, we hopefully are seeing how deeply integrated these are and dependent upon. They're reliant on each other. And the climax image is that in a sense, it's not so much how we train in the Zen tradition, but in a sense, everything before leading up to this, because remember, it begins with the wisdom aspects and then the Shila, the sort of compassion and or morality aspects, and then the meditation aspects. And that one way of looking at that, in that way of presenting it, is that all of this, in a sense, is preparing us to actually enter into the most profound aspect, which is meditation. And that in our training, that's the first thing we give you. That's the first thing we're given, is the meditation. And in a certain sense, that's totally appropriate and totally necessary. And in another sense, it's completely outrageous. Because we are so not ready for that, most of us. But that's part of how the Zen tradition works, is that we, in a sense, enter into the whole thing at once. And then spend the rest of our lives in training, understanding what we've done. Right, mindfulness is, I was thinking about when I first came into training and, I was really ignorant and arrogant in my ignorance, and there was so much that I did not understand. And there was enough that I thought I understood to not be skillful. And partly because of what was happening with mindfulness even back in those days and the way it was talked about, I just assumed that it was sort of, I don't know, kind of lightweight Dharma in some way, that it was something that was happening over here and wasn't really the most important thing. And I came to find out otherwise. In essence, you could say without these various aspects of the Eightfold Path, it's not Buddhism, it's not Buddha Dharma. This is what makes it Buddha Dharma. Without mindfulness, it's not Buddha Dharma. Without mindfulness, we, in a sense, we can't even talk about the rest of these things. Or maybe that's all we can do, is talk about them. It's very difficult to practice them. Our efforts to practice them will be so hampered, so limited, that it will be very difficult to experience the benefit, the reason why these aspects are important, much less their integration, much less how they are part of a path of awakening. And so in that way, that sense of preparation to actually begin practicing meditation and in earnest take up the practice of mindfulness is so that we can really begin to discover not just Buddha Dharma, but this person, this life, this mind, the whole thing. So in a very real sense, it is impossible to overstate the importance of this. And that's part of the challenge, is because it is so important, it needs to be spoken of over and over again, which means, in a certain sense, it gets harder and harder to hear it. Right? The more we hear something, the harder it is to keep hearing it. That as we begin practicing something, in a way, it should be getting easier, and in another way, it can get harder to practice it because we think we're doing it. Or even worse, we have done it. And now what's the next thing? And so mindfulness is really, the practice of mindfulness is like being invited into the great hall of your mind. So let's understand a little bit about what my right mindfulness is. I want to read some of the things from the text because it's nice to hear how things are expressed by the teachers. And this is Piyadasi, who's quoting the Buddha. And the Buddha says, "How, by protecting others, can you protect yourself?" I'm paraphrasing a little bit. So how do you protect yourself and others? How do you ensure well-being for yourself and others. It is by forbearance, by harmlessness, by loving kindness, and by compassion. You must practice the foundations of mindfulness in saying, I will protect myself and I will protect others. This is how we ensure or apply ourselves to the well-being of ourselves and others. It's through the foundations of mindfulness, and through that, and in order to do that, we must bring forth forbearance, patience, harmlessness, loving kindness, and compassion. He talks about heedfulness, the word apamada, I'm not sure if that's how it's pronounced, Sanskrit, which he says, Piyadasi says, is very close to the word sati. So sati is what has been translated as mindfulness. And mindfulness is a word that a early scholar, I can't remember exactly who it was, I think Thanissara talks about this, coined the term back maybe in the 19th century, something, it was a while ago, and it took on and it became really the English equivalent of sati. But this term, apamada, which is translated as heedfulness, he said it literally means, which is very close to sati, which is mindfulness, literally means the non-neglect of mindfulness. So when we're not neglecting mindfulness, that's being heedful. I was, just as I was sitting before I came over, I was, what came to mind was the Evening Gatha, take heed, be heedful. That in the Buddha's final words, he said, strive on with heedfulness. All conditioned things are subject to decay. You should practice diligently with and be heedful, which again he's equating with mindfulness, which means not to neglect it, not to neglect mindfulness. The Buddha also said, mindfulness, I declare, is essential in all things everywhere. And Piyadasi talks about the relationship between mindfulness and what is spoken of as a Sanskrit term, which is translated as clear comprehension, clear seeing, clear understanding, seeing without obscurations, seeing things as they are. And so how intimately connected these are. And that's why I think it's safe to say that without the development and the ongoing development and deepening and strengthening of our mindfulness, despite our best efforts and our sincere efforts, it will be very difficult to do what we want to do. You know, if you've, in any of the moments where you've seen something happening, you know, something's going on and you see yourself getting, you know, raising up inside or building up defenses or, you know, getting ready to react. And, you know, with some practice, there can be enough awareness to know that that's what's happening. You see it happening, and even to know what you need to do. Where do you need to turn your attention? How do you use your mind in this moment? But without sufficient mindfulness, you may very well not be able to do that. You just simply can't. Right? Not because it's not inherent in your consciousness to be able to do that, but we haven't developed the ability, the strength, in a sense, the stability of mind and mindfulness to be able to do that in the presence of a stronger force, right? A stronger karmic force. And that can be so much of our frustration, you know. And so that's where the more we develop this, the easier things get, and the more we're able to actually sort of move more in alignment with our intentions. He also speaks about, Piyadasi talks about, he says the word sati carries the meaning of memory or remembrance, the calling to mind, which is a very important part of that. And I'll read some passages from the Buddha where he speaks of this. But then he goes on to talk about how in right mindfulness, as with all of the other aspects of the Eightfold Path, there is its counterpart, which is what is not right mindfulness, what is not right understanding, not right intention, and so on. And the way he describes that is that but what he says is that that what is not right mindfulness is when we turn our mindfulness to something which is, he described as evil. You know, something that is deluded, that is harmful, that is not worthy of our mindfulness. And which was interesting because, you know, sometimes the question has come up of, which is sometimes sort of bridging mindfulness and concentration, but what if you're very mindful while you're doing something that is harmful? Is that mindfulness? And so based on what Piyadasi is saying, you could say it's mindfulness, but it's wrongly applied. And as I reflected on that, and maybe I'm not really seeing this correctly, or it's not in alignment with how this would be understood in terms of traditional teachings, is that that would not be mindfulness because it would be void, absent of certain qualities that mindfulness needs to have in order to be right mindfulness, which we'll be getting to, which have a moral component, moral aspect. And so that's the way I've always thought of it, is that it, even though a person might be concentrated, in a state of concentration, it's not right concentration. They might be mindful, but it's not right mindfulness because it's absent of that moral aspect. Bhikkhu Bodhi says some nice things about this. He says, the kind of awareness, mindfulness is presence of mind, attentiveness, awareness, which is how most of us usually think of it, and that's true, but there's more to it. He says, but the kind of awareness involved in mindfulness differs profoundly from the kind of awareness at work in our usual mode of consciousness. All consciousness involves awareness in the sense of a knowing or experiencing. Right? But with the practice of mindfulness, awareness is applied in a special way. The mind is deliberately kept at the level of bare attention, a detached observation of what is happening within us and around us in the present moment. In the practice of right mindfulness, the mind is trained to remain in that present moment, open, quiet, and alert, contemplating the present event. And contemplating here means to see it clearly and to understand it. Not necessarily to be engaged in kind of dialogic contemplation. All judgments and interpretations have to be suspended, or if they occur, they're seen and released. The practice is simply to note whatever comes up just as it is occurring, riding the changes of events in the way a surfer rides the waves on the sea. You could think of that analogy as staying on top rather than being drawn under. He said, it might be assumed that we're always aware of the present, but this is a mirage. Only seldom do we become aware of the present in the precise way in which we speak of as right mindfulness. In ordinary consciousness, the mind begins a cognitive process, a cognitive engaging thinking process, conceptual process, with some impression given in the present. So there's an impression of what's happening in the present moment. But the consciousness does not stay with that. It has a brief encounter with what is happening in the present moment, but it doesn't stay with that. Instead, it uses that immediate impression, and here the word appropriation is appropriate, because the mind seizes on that present moment and appropriates it for other purposes, right? And we do that because the mind experiences that as in being that moment as being insufficient. It's not enough. And then, of course, this is not happening at a conscious level. We're not making conscious decisions. This is all happening so quickly, we don't see it. It's so integrated, we're not aware of it. And so it uses that immediate impression or appropriates it as a springboard for building blocks of mental constructs which remove it from the sheer facticity of the datum, which basically means it's pulling it away from the actual experience, and now basically the appearance of that object, you know, we might still have it in our visual or audible senses, but the mind is subtly turning towards the imprint of that in our mind, in our consciousness. So this is where the mind as one of the sense organs becomes very central. And now it's basically appropriated, so it's like I'm going to take that and use it to build from it what I want, right? Because this is not what I want. The cognitive process is generally interpretive. The mind perceives its object free from conceptualization only briefly. And then immediately after grasping that initial impression, it launches on a course of ideation, thought, by which it seeks to interpret the object to itself, to make it intelligible in terms of its own, it being the self, in terms of its own categories and assumptions. So we take something and we're trying to interpret it so that not only do we understand it according to our own framework, but that it serves our purpose. It gives us what we need, right? What we desire. To bring this about, the mind posits concepts, and it joins those concepts into constructions, sets of mutually corroborative concepts, so they're all working together, and then weaves the constructs together into complex interpretive schemes. In the end, the original direct experience has been overrun by ideation. It's almost been pushed to the side, and the presented object appears only dimly through dense layers of ideas and views, like the moon through a layer of clouds. The Buddha calls this process of mental construction elaboration, embellishment, or conceptual proliferation. And these elaborations block out the presentational immediacy of phenomena, the immediacy, the aliveness, the sacredness, the truth, the vitality, that which is ultimately revealing and satisfying. It blocks that out because we can't perceive that directly with the senses, and so it seems unsatisfying. And so we can create something with our mind that gives us a momentary experience that we take as satisfaction. And that's the embellishment. But the elaborations do not only screen cognition, they also serve as a basis for projections. The deluded mind, cloaked in ignorance, projects its own internal constructs outwardly, ascribing them to the objects as if they really belonged to them. So because we're not seeing this process, the characteristics that we have now constructed and imputed into that object, we assume, are that object itself. And so one of the most, I mean, this, and so, if we think of just this happening all the time in everything, and then the implications of that, and some of the most profound implications, or perhaps the most profound implications, are how we do this towards people, right? So if you take all of this and you apply it to our, where the object of experience before us is a person, right, in which we have a brief instant of awareness, of contact, and the mind appropriates that image, right, and then begins to embellish and elaborate, proliferate all of these constructions, based on what? So where are all of these proliferations coming from? Well, of course, that's our karma. So those are all the accumulated experiences and messages and images and experiences that we've had and been given, right? Which have basically taught us to see, to appropriate that image in a particular way. So when psychologists, sociologists talk about the mind as being wired to discriminate, to see differences between things, between people, to recognize sameness and difference, but that society tells us what it means, what those differences mean, that's shorthand for all of this very elaborate, intensely sophisticated and complex building in the mind that is based in very particular motives, desires. And so when I talk about, you know, that we appropriate it to serve our needs, well, that's where our becomes collaborative, right? So if you think of this in terms of different forms of bias and oppression, so that as a white person or as a man or however we are present ourselves in the world, however we've been seen, the meaning that's been given, all the experiences we've had, then that becomes, all of that becomes the meaning that we impute into the object. And so that's how, you know, we're conditioned to see people of different groups and have actual experiences of pleasure or danger, of closeness or distance, of worthiness or unworthiness, of intelligence or lack of intelligence. Right? And not seeing that process, we attribute those characteristics to being of that person, right? Even though we have never seen them before and don't know anything about them. But because of all of that karmic, we have been told, based on all of those views and the intentions behind them, what to think about them. In a sense, we've been told, this is all you need to know about this person and to serve the purpose of that, in a sense, that dominant group, right? And so when, for those of you who were here yesterday with Greg Snyder, who was talking about this, and he was talking about, you know, how can we understand the nature of the self, study the self, if we don't examine in this? He didn't go into a lot of detail about that, but this is how I understand that. Because obviously, if we don't, the fact that we don't see it happening just means that we just don't see it happening. Right? It's happening all the time. And the only way it stops happening, that we can break that cycle, is when we begin to see it happening. Right? We begin to take charge, in a sense, reclaim our mind, our consciousness, that has been kidnapped, in a sense, right? And it's always kidnapped. I mean, anywhere you grow up, it's going to be, in a sense, conditioned. I mean, that's a kind of, you know, particular way of presenting it. You know, it's a negative way of presenting it. And you know, it's not that all that we learn and all that we're socialized to believe in is wrong or bad, but enough is. So he says, the springs for this process of fabrication hidden from you are the latent defilements. He says, to correct these erroneous notions is the task of wisdom. But for wisdom to discharge its work effectively, right, in order for us to both realize wisdom and for it to be able to release us, right? Because insight is just insight, right? That's direct experience, but for that direct experience to actually release us from all of this, he says it needs direct access to the object as it is in itself. In others, we have to go trace it back to. So with that realization of truth, of reality, of consciousness, now unconstructed, unconditioned, no longer appropriating, right? That's why he talks about mindfulness as needing to, he describes it as bare attention, right? In which we see present, open, quiet, alert. What he's saying is that's the opposite of those are all of those activities, right? Which are creating, getting involved in all of that construction. So it needs direct access to the object as it is in itself uncluttered by the conceptual elaborations. So to practice mindfulness is thus a matter not so much of doing, right? So seeing that there's this whole busy work of overlaying, so now we need to bring a whole new construction team in, right? Right? Like we're going to Jesus' house. So first we're going to tear it down, and then we're going to build a new one, right? So that's kind of our model. So we're going to deconstruct it and then build the right thing. So he's saying no. He said it's not so much a matter of doing, but of undoing, or rather not doing. Even that idea of deconstruction, I mean, there's, you know, there's some truth to that, but it's really, but even that leads us in the wrong direction. He says, not thinking, not judging, not association, not planning, not imagining, not wishing. All of those impulses are calmed. That's what mindfulness does. That's what it allows us to do. He says all of these doings of ours are modes of interference, ways the mind manipulates the experience and tries to establish its dominance. The mind tries to establish its dominance, right, over internal and external everything. For what reason? To try and find safety, connection, happiness, joy, freedom from danger, from sadness, from sorrow. And not finding that in that first contact based on just our sensory perceptions, and then with that onrush of mental proliferation, we conclude that the only way to go about it is to just, you know, gather in as much good as you can, hang out with the people who completely affirm your everything, and anybody who's a threat, keep them outside the gate. And so when we see that happening in real time, right, when we see policies and legislations and laws and executive decisions and on and on and on, that's the way I see it, is that's it happening. That's what we do all the time, happening in a field of great power, right? In a position of great reach, of great impact, and it's making it manifest, right? So we all build walls in our mind, but when we, you know, if we take it a step further, we build an actual wall. He says to lead. Okay, so let me just stop there because I've said a bit and see if there are any questions before we go on. I want to get a little bit into the actual sort of guts of mindfulness.
When you're talking about the, or I'm not sure who you were reading from, was that Piyadasi Thera? When we're talking about these latent tendencies, are those karmic imprints? Is that what's being mm-hmm. referred to? Mm-hmm. So the releasing of those would be the realization of emptiness? Is that?
Ultimately, yes. Okay. But this is, again, where the Eightfold Path becomes the essential thing. And by the way, let me make a plug for the Bill Waldron retreat that's coming up, because he's talking about the Yogacara, and particularly the Alaya, this deep level of consciousness in which all of these karmic imprints, these seeds, are residing, and that we don't have direct access to. And so, but the way that we, and that ultimately need to be transformed at the base, which is the way it's described, And which is what realization does, that that's why right understanding is the ultimate transformation. And he's going to talk about, based in, you know, ancient teachings, about that collaborative, that understanding of that collaborative, collective aspect of consciousness and karma. And so how we are, you know, responsible for our own actions, but we're also, we and ourselves, in a sense, have been appropriated, right? We have been appropriated by systems, by structures, by groups, by a story of a nation state, all of these things, which is, you know, part of how you build. I mean, that can be used for incredible good, right? So it's not solely negative. It can be, I mean, in a way, a sangha is coming together and bonding and joining together and sort of create and having a sense of one, right, and the many, and in that way becoming a force, you know, becoming something larger than an individual, and that is based in a view. I mean, it's a lot of the same stuff, and which can also become dangerous, right? And what makes it so important in Buddhism is all of that stuff, that same stuff, that can be used for nefarious purposes as well as for very honorable, noble purposes, is all understood as this very stuff. It's all mental construction. So we're going to get together and consciously construct a community. We're going to consciously construct what we call training. We're going to construct these various forms and methods and practices and teachings and so on, right? And understand they are constructions. So because the moment we forget that, then we grab onto them, we become self-righteous. We are both the appropriator and the appropriated, and it all starts to turn to shit, right? And so, going back to making the plug for the Bill Waldron retreat. But did that answer your question? I didn't actually intend to even go off in this direction tonight. Robbie, right behind you.
So I was thinking about not right mindfulness, and just like reflecting on like a personal experience of going shopping and seeing like a pastry that I wanted, mm-hmm. and thinking to myself like that like just like through my practice I could be like more effectively like do the, you know, just take it, you know, just to steal that, mm-hmm. and that like in like perhaps like past situations my mind would have, mm-hmm. you know, spun out of control and like been overcome by, you know, guilt and mm-hmm. just like paranoia, mm-hmm. But that through, you know, having developed the mind in a certain way I'd be less susceptible to that, but it would of course be not right mindfulness because I'm using it for
you'd be less susceptible to the guilt and the paranoia.
Yeah, I guess like I could like effectively like calm down in that moment and just like do the act.
Yeah, perhaps, but I think that I would think of that as going back to what I was saying before, whereas if you are developing your mindfulness and at the same time equally developing your own moral compass, mm-hmm. studying the action, the truth of cause and effect, you know, then in that moment you see that impulse or that desire, but you can see beyond that moment. Right, and that helps to also create the sense of, you know, how do you really need this that much that you would put this in jeopardy, right? That you would, you know, this consequence to yourself, and also how that might become a larger thing, you know. So that's where, if we sort of extract mindfulness out of the Eightfold Path, you know, but we don't, mm-hmm. right? That's the whole point. So, but to sort of take that a little bit further, let me read some from some of the Buddha's own teachings. And so here he's talking about the faculty of sati, mindfulness, or sati, which is has that meaning of remembering. The Buddha said there's the case where a disciple, a noble disciple, has sati, is endowed with excellent proficiency in sati, remembering and recollecting what was done and said a long time ago. They remain focused on the body in and of itself. So now this is, so sati is mindfulness, right? And satipatthana is the foundations of mindfulness, this essential sort of seminal teaching of the Buddha on the practice of meditation and specifically mindfulness and how it leads to liberation. And so, and there are two early sutras where that are basically satipatthana sutras. One is shorter, the other is longer. So you remain focused on the body in and of itself, ardent, alert, and having sati, subduing greed and distress with reference to the world. You remain focused on feelings in and of themselves, on mind in and of itself, and on mental qualities or mind objects in and of themselves. So those are the four foundations: body, feelings, mind, and mind objects. And in each of those practices, there is remembering and recollecting what was done, remaining focused on that aspect in and of itself, ardent, alert, and having sati. And so let's look at what he means by those qualities. And then this gets back to what you were saying. So alertness, so when Bhikkhu Bodhi talks about being present and open in the present moment, which is how sort of the general understanding of mindfulness, that's true, but there's more than that, right? That whole sense of bare awareness can be absent of certain qualities, you could say. And so this is where the Buddha is fleshing, is sort of saying more about what is important to have in that awareness. And so alertness, so it's, which is kind of what helps it to be not a kind of, to be in the present moment means it's not a blank. But, let me not try and explain it that way. Let me let the Buddha say it. So what is it to be alert? The Buddha says this: when going forward and returning, you make yourself or you practice being alert. When looking toward or looking away, when bending and extending your limbs, when carrying your outer garment, your bowl, when eating, drinking, chewing, and savoring, when urinating and defecating, when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, remaining alert, remaining silent, you make yourself alert. This is how a student is alert. So, you know, in our training, we make this very explicit during session, but it's really the training every day, and it's not just here, is exactly this, right? That in waking, you wake in mindfulness. And if you wake apart from mindfulness, you remember. You return, right? And then you're lying down. And then you're sitting up in that mindfulness. And then you stand in mindfulness. And then you dress in your clothing mindfully. And then you walk mindfully. That's the practice, right? This is the fundamental practice. And he's very explicit, I'm sure, for a very, very precise purpose. He wants us to understand, right? Because we would otherwise, you know, if he leaves gaps out, we'll leave gaps out, We'll make gaps. Well, he didn't mention this, right? He didn't mention pissing and shitting. Like, so I don't have to be mindful of that, right? So he's explicit. All right, so that's, and so what does that mean to know? It just means that. That when you stand, you're aware. You're in your standing. You're aware. It doesn't mean that you're standing outside and commenting on it and narrating it and interpreting it. You just know. You're inside of that experience. As opposed to standing and not knowing. Right? Walking out the door and not knowing you're walking out the door because you're somewhere else. You're already thinking about how you're going to make your cup of coffee. How many people are going to be there? You're going to have to wait in line. You know, what's going to happen when you get to the bathroom? You're going to, you know, you're not actually walking.
I'm just remembering. This is White.
The earlier days of my practice and like hearing that instruction on like just do the thing and just know what you're doing and feeling so mystified by it, being like, I don't have access to that. Like, I can't, I know that that's not what I'm doing. I'm like opening the refrigerator and I'm like, I can see, I'm like caught. And I'm trying to remember, you know, that's not my present experience. And I'm trying to remember, was that like just so gradual? I can't see how that shifts, or I don't know. I just wondered if you had thoughts on how does that shift or open?
Well, yes, gradually, I think it must. And I remember too, you know, time getting so tied up in knots about, you know, what is it? What am I supposed to be doing? Right? And I think it was really, it was what he was saying, which is, I, you know, there was a sense of, I need to be doing something special, something different, something. Like there's all of this mental activity, there's all of this distraction, and I needed to do something. And I just was compounding it.
Like rather than the undoing.
Yeah. I was making it so complicated and getting, you know, so built up and wrought up in it rather than just, and I didn't know how to relax. I hadn't really encountered that yet, you know. And I think it was, my meditation wasn't developed, and also I was, you know, I just didn't understand and was trying, figuring it out. But it always felt that somehow it was right here and it was never here, you know. And it seemed so far away, even though I thought, well, it can't be. It's got to be right here. But where is it, you know? And part of it was, I think, looking for something, you know. So it was like trying to create some kind of experience, you know, that I'm sure I already had formed in my mind. Probably, you know, unconsciously, and trying to kind of get to that. And so it was just, you know, just relax, you know. So he then talks about ardency. So remember now in the, in this section is spoken of over and over and over again. It's a kind of a formula in a way, and that's part of the remembering. Right? So sati, part of the function of sati is remembering, recalling the Dharma, recalling the teaching. So you have it in your mind. What was I supposed to do? What were those four foundations? What are those qualities? Right? So that you can recall them and have them. So he says you remain focused on the body, and this is generally referred to as the breathing, ardent, alert, and having sati. So alert, we talked about, which is knowing where you are, knowing what's happening in that moment. And ardency, he speaks of, is the desire to avoid what is unbeneficial. And so the Buddha said, how is one ardent? There's the case where a student thinking, unarisen evil, unskillful qualities arising in me would lead to what is unbeneficial. And that arouses ardency. Thinking arisen evil, unskillful qualities that are not being abandoned by me, you know, as I'm grabbing onto them, I'm perpetuating them, unarisen skillful qualities that are not arising in me, that are not being that are not being brought forward, and arisen skillful qualities ceasing in me would lead to what is beneficial. All of these arouse ardency. And so ardency, and so what is that? What is this related to? That which has arisen, which is unskillful.
Effort.
Right. It's essentially right effort. Right? So within mindfulness, it's recognizing those things, those characteristics, those mind streams, those states that arise that are unskillful and not being abandoned in me. I'm holding on to them. I'm pursuing them. That arouses ardency, which has a moral component to it, right? This is not going to help. This is not good for me. This is going to cause me to suffer. This is going to make it much more likely that I'm going to cause others to suffer. Because this is what I'm developing. This is the mind. This is the karma that I'm creating, right? I'm strengthening. And so in that way, he also talks about compunction as a sort of cousin to this ardency. In other words, that sense of not of wrongdoing or not wanting to act in a way that is unskillful. And at the same time, recognizing what is skillful. And so when you're sitting and you see things arise, right? And so you feel faith arising, or you're practicing and it's difficult and you bring forth patience. And because you are alert, you see that, you know that you are experiencing or bringing forth patience, and ardency is recognizing that is good. Right? That's actually going to serve me well. So I want to strengthen that. Right? I want to let that be present and build on that. Whereas when I see impatience arising, right, I see that because I'm alert. And I recognize that does not help. Right? I know that doesn't help. So that's ardency. And so I focus on trying to let that drop away. Okay, so that kind of comes back to where mindfulness has those sort of active qualities. And this is where mindfulness and clear comprehension, that mindfulness is not a dead awareness, it's not a dull awareness, not just in the sense of being sleepy or tired, but also in the sense of being kind of just cut off. You know, so you're actually seeing, you're experiencing in that mindfulness what's arising, and are able to, because it's very alive, are able to recognize it in these ways and then respond to it in ways that are really powerful and effective and are essentially, you know, strengthening what you want to be strengthening and are softening and letting drop away what you don't want to be strengthening.
Thank you, Roshi. You've mentioned a number of times now a sense of a moral compass and a right and a wrong. And I guess I kind of get mixed up in the duality of the language. And I guess I'm just, especially in my own experience, when thinking about a moral compass in my own life, it can become very rigid. In a sense. Mm-hmm. And like you said, you know, it becomes another construct. You know, mm-hmm. It's just something that I build, and you know, in that there's a grasping and a mm-hmm. sense to maintain that mm-hmm. and to then impose and appropriate all these other things to make sure that that moral compass and that sense of right and wrong maintain and stay strong. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I don't know if you could speak to that in a sense, because you know, in one instance, something that is really unskillful, like impatience, could be just that, very unskillful. But then in another instance, like, you know, and kind of, you know, just as an example, like sense of global climate change, like it's kind of good to have a sense of impatience about this. Mm-hmm. It's not something that we can really dwell on very much longer, you know, or, you know, just as an example, you know, in some cases, one skillful means might not be that skillful. you know, or something that's good actually might cause more harm. Mm-hmm. You know, so I was wondering if you could possibly speak to that.
Well, in terms of, you know, that scene that you know, sense of morality, you know, grasping and becoming rigid, I mean, my suggestion would be, don't do that. I mean, that's our business, right? Is to see that which we are solidifying and reifying and objectifying, and whether it started out as unskillful or whether it started out as skillful. It's the same practice, you know, that's what we are developing. That's why this is so important, is so that we can actually recognize that. And in that, you're also going to be able to recognize the grasping, right? Because in that mindfulness, you see it, and you experience it, and you're also experiencing the consequences of it. And the more mindful you are, the more keenly you experience it. Whereas in the beginning, without the mindfulness, we may not have any sense of what's going on. Or we may sense something but totally misunderstand it, misread it, not really understand what's going on, right? Because we're too distant, we're too distracted. We're not paying attention. We don't really haven't developed that capacity within our mind, even though it's inherent. And so, but, you know, the other part of that is sometimes when we're trying to shift, and particularly shift old, deep tendencies that have a lot of energy, sometimes we have to be a little, you know, a little righteous to just gain some footing. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, sometimes we have to apply a particular kind of force and energy to get to a place of relative stability. It's sort of like when you're sitting, you know, and your mind is just haywire. And, you know, for most people to just sit in a very relaxed mind, they're just going to be all over the place. And so we apply a certain kind of effort in our mindfulness and concentration to try and hold that breath in our awareness, to develop that mindfulness and concentration. And often in doing that, we're overreaching a little bit, right? We're over-efforting. And so the mind is a little tight, the body gets a little tense, you know, and that has consequences. Hopefully we're also developing some of that mindfulness and concentration, and as that develops, we will need less and less to over-effort. And that can happen in all kinds of things. You know, somebody was asking yesterday in the talk with Greg about, you know, how when we're not accustomed to having difficult conversations with people, you know, white people with people of color or men with women or, you know, whatever the difference is, that we just haven't practiced that. And the kind of self-consciousness and the awkwardness and, you know, and the bumbling and the mistakes we might make and the feelings we might hurt and so on. And, I mean, that's part of it. So sometimes in our effort to move in the right direction, right, to release ourselves from some of these negative patterns and cycles and develop new skills, develop new capacities, you can't do it in the abstract. You know, you have to do it. And we haven't really developed that ease. We haven't developed that sense of, you know, equanimity or balance. It's we're in really new terrain. And so we will oftentimes overdo it, you know. And then there's, you know, consequence, there's an awkwardness and so on, and we might feel bad, but that's how else are we going to learn? And so in one way we can, you know, particularly in interacting with people, we can do our work and try and develop ourselves as much as we can within ourselves. I mean, that's what these affinity groups, part of the function of these affinity groups, is we develop that capacity within our persons and within our affinity groups, our identity groups, so that we can venture into that realm of beginning having those conversations and hearing our mind and encountering that in each other, so that when we step out into a more multiracial conversation, we're better prepared, so we're not going to just be starting from scratch and hurting people unnecessarily.
So that kind of, in a sense, almost develops a sense of gratitude for the difficulties and the suffering, because that's where we can actually make the most change.
Yes, and humility and patience and, you know, I mean, how do we learn anything? How else do we learn anything? You know, we got to get out there and do it, you know. And, I mean, you've been learning some new things, right, in your trade. And so, but, you know, your boss didn't just throw you out there and say, okay, go, you know, install this new system, right? So we move sort of incrementally and sort of we start on safer ground, and then we move forward a little bit, all right? And make mistakes at each point along the way. And that's part of, you know, when he was talking about yesterday, he was talking about the shame and the resilience, you know, that we will feel at certain moments embarrassed or ashamed or guilty or remorseful. So that comes with it. So we have to learn how to manage that and hold that in a healthy way, a skillful way, and use it. And then the resilience is exactly that. How do we use it? How do we come back and take another step? And, you know, I mean, you know, there's just no way anything good happens. There's no way we're going to make any headway in Dharma practice, in the study of the self, but for this, right? And so we have to have courage, and that's one reason the Sangha is so important. Because when you find yourself reticent and unwilling to do that because you're afraid, and then you see somebody else step forward, and they stumble, and it's like, and we keep going, right? The world doesn't stop, the building doesn't collapse, everybody doesn't leave. We keep going. And hopefully you even see how people repair, you know, or respond skillfully and stay connected, stay in a relationship. It's like, oh, you can do that. I can do that, right? It gives us courage. It's part of how we help each other.
I want to make sure I have the proper understanding using the arising of a physical sensation, say a beating heart, fast beating heart, or a feeling of grief somewhere. Is mindfulness feeling it and having the capacity to continue moving forward with whatever you're doing? So like genuinely feeling into it, whether that's the heart beating or that grief, and continuing to be mindful of what you're doing? Or is it noticing it and, I mean, this, not tuning it out, but noticing it only in a way that you think it's going to kind of diminish as you focus on something else?
What I would say is to just try and experience it without adding anything. In other words, when you see your mind bringing something in, a judgment, you know, a memory, an idea, that you try and, because now that's between you and that emotion, say, right? So if you can let that go, that which is much more of an object in your mind, and is you can let that go, and then come back to the emotion, which is an embodied experience, then you will be practicing mindfulness. And I think that's a better guide. The way I heard your question could be more, what is the experience I'm supposed to be having? Mm-hmm. And then we'll try and create that. And whereas rather, can I let go of trying to create an experience, right? Of trying to add something to this and just meet it in a kind of nakedness.
Okay. So if it's a hollowness of grief, mm-hmm. to just, I mean, experience it and continue with what you're doing.
Yeah, because those are words that you're now using to describe something that maybe you've had a more direct experience of, right? You're trying to stay with the experience itself. So even to not, you don't have to name it. You don't have to know, right? Because as soon as you name it, that just brings in, that sort of the opens the door to all of that, right? Because words are so powerful. That's another thing Bill Waldron, I hope we'll talk about, is the role of language, which is so incredibly, intimately connected. It is consciousness, really, and consciousness making. So when we suspend that, right, and we're language, we don't bring language in, then it just, again, is one more aspect of not doing.
Okay, thank you.
And then you will, the rest, in a sense, will guide you. Because really what you're doing there also is you're not avoiding it, and you're not elaborating on it, right? And your natural mind, which is the whole system, at that moment, knows exactly what to do.
I was going to ask just about this, but I've had a sense that the teachings sometimes point to identifying your experience as X or Y. And when I first encountered this, it seemed contrary to my sense, mm-hmm. Of what I take in mindfulness to be, mm-hmm. and yet it seemed pretty it was not casual about it. Sometimes it was pretty direct, mm-hmm. To see this as X, Y, or Z. So sometimes it seems more like an interpretation, sometimes applying a kind of moral, notion to your experience. But sometimes also just in a very base level of saying, like, I'm raising my limbs, it seems that in that exercise, even if it's barely verbal, if mm-hmm. such a thing is possible, mm-hmm. There's already a kind of, in the focusing of the attention that it is kind of adding something there, just in saying, like, I'm noticing my limbs, as opposed to having another experience in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is, but that may be okay, and it may be actually be helpful in that moment, in a way that can. That's one example. The other is in sitting, of just noting. So, given what I just said to Paul, that sometimes it is helpful to just note, sort of label, basically, just a word. And, that's more of a sort of a formal practice in other traditions. But sometimes I will ask students to do that. And usually it's when my sense is, that either because they're telling me or just I'm sensing it, that they may be moving too quickly past whatever's arising. They're in too much of a rush to let go and come back to the breath. They're seeing this as too much of an impediment or obstruction, and so they're not really making contact. They're not really bringing mindfulness. And so by labeling, what it does is it slows them down a little bit, and it kind of makes them make contact so that they can actually identify it. Another way that this is used a little bit more is when I at times would sort of witness what I was doing and sort of, be the person in the wing saying, when I'd be like sitting and being really apathetic or complacent, and the person in the wings, me, would say, oh, you think you're going to live forever. And that was really helpful. So, because it brought me up again, right? And so, this is where, kind of going back to something Nolan said, this is where that we don't want to make any of this rigid, right? So practice is a constant, it's everything is impermanent. Everything is changing. And in every moment, you're trying to, apply right effort. So, what is skillful, what is not? How do you develop and then sustain mindfulness? And through all of the movements of your body and your mind and everything. There's a lot going on there, right? And so we can't just make a rule, about how you apply yourself, because there's so many different conditions that you find yourself in, and you're learning about you, right? About what is a skillful way for you to respond. You know, so because of my conditioning, when I would sometimes sort of kick myself in the ass and say, come on, don't be such a, you know, blah, blah, you know, sort of like my coaches would do. Get out there and, like, you know, do it like you mean it, right? That, I felt, was okay for me, you know, because it didn't become punitive, right? It didn't lead to kind of self-criticism and self-hatred. But I would not suggest some other people to do that, right? And so that's where you got to find the things that are going to be really helpful to you based on what is skillful and what's not. And that's, we learn that by seeing how do we use different things, right? Whether it's coming from the outside or it's something that you're creating.
Kind of going back to what Paul and Eduardo just brought up, you know, I feel like there's a way in which when a feeling state arises, there are times when it's like so important for me to know, like, this is what's happening, mm-hmm. you know, like this mm-hmm. is, oh, this is grief.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm just in the sea of like my emotional morass and I'm untethered.
Right.
And I also feel like there are times when that feeling arises when it's actually beneficial to stop what I'm doing and just, you know, not for like hours on end, but a few moments to just really be completely present
yeah.
with that.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, I think that's really important. And that's where, you know, we need to be our own judge. And that's where intention can also be really important. You know, I mean, I talk to people sometimes, sometimes new people who are coming to session, and I realize, you know, you really came here to just work out a bunch of stuff. And, you know, you're sitting on the cushion and you're just working stuff out. You know, that's not a bad thing. It's probably helping them. It's not really exactly what, you know, we've set up session for. But, you know, they're in charge, you know. And so... you know, I'm, you know, I've changed my way of responding to those kinds of things, you know, so I try and see, you know, what is, and if I know the person better, it's easier. But it's like, what is actually going to be helpful for them, and then, you know, sometimes, you know, it's really important to let yourself go with that, because you often don't. You being anyone, you know, or you're finally allowing yourself to do that when you really haven't, or it's arising, you know, like you're feeling some grief that the source of which is a long time ago and it never arose. You know, I've talked to people lots of times actually who said that when somebody close to them died, they never grieved, they never cried, they never felt it. And now a year or years later, they are. And so I would not encourage them to immediately let that go, you know. Yeah, I mean, honor that. And I think if, you know, for a person on the path, what helps us to know how to do that is just understanding ourselves, and that if, you know, our basic intention is that we're moving towards freeing ourselves, so that the value of that is in and of itself. And so we're learning how to experience that emotion, that part of our humanity, to meet that karma, that history, and sort of, you know, embrace our whole humanity within mindfulness, within practice, and really see it that way. And to know or to discover that that's actually going to help us to release it. Right? And that release, letting go of that in this moment, being on the path of non-attachment in this moment may mean you turn towards it and you let it go. You go into it. You walk with it for a while. Right? Or you let it carry you. for a while. And so it doesn't look like non-attachment, right? But it's mindfulness because you see what's happening, you have understanding, and there's a sense this is good. You know, this is helpful. It is skillful. And you're in it. You're aware of it, right? And so it's different than just being taken over by an emotion that, you know. Does that?
Yeah, I guess I'm having like a little bit of a like reaction internally because I feel like my experience of feeling my feelings and feeling emotion is like completely non-dual with my experience of aliveness mm-hmm. and being like awake and like liberating my experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so there's just like subtle things in what I'm hearing that make me feel like, wait, are you talking about it like it's this kind of side piece of, or, you know, a tributary of practice rather than like a arterial branch or something like this?
No, not at all. Yeah. I mean, when it's arising, it is practice. It is the practice,
okay.
Right? I mean, I would say that more and more, yes, we are able to experience that as not a part and as really being, I mean, in mindfulness, it both becomes more and more powerful because there's less in the way and calmer because there's less in the way. And so the feeling of it, the experience of it is more immediate and more alive. There is more aliveness. But at the same time, there's a calmness to it because there's not a lot of the sort of karmic, you know, things that often come along. That when we are more entangled, we can interpret as aliveness because we may not have experienced a sort of a less cluttered or more direct experience of aliveness. So we take this as aliveness, and that's how we can get hooked on that, you know, roller coaster. So,
I have a question about the continuous kind of mindfulness from we talked about before, from like sitting to walking and always being mindful. I still often have the sense that like even if I'm sitting, I'm aware I'm sitting, but am I aware enough of my sitting? You know what I mean? It's like it feels like I could feel it even more. And this is, so am I fishing for an experience, or is it just the sense that it, with practice, even something as simple as sitting will deepen?
Well, both. But I think, yeah, that sounds a little bit like fishing.
Okay.
But, you know, I mean, we're sort of a culture that's hooked on experiences, you know, to make us feel alive or to make our lives feel meaningful. And so that we're being sold experiences in every direction. And so how could we not come into this? I mean, this is the mother lode of experiences, right? It's the holy grail of experiences. So how could you not want that, right? And so I think it's unrealistic to think we're just going to come in and say, oh, I get it, no goal. Okay, yeah, I'm good with that. You know? And so, but you see it, and that's where you're working that out, right? Because we do that by getting hooked and by going after it and by trying to create it, and then you see yourself moving further and further away from it, or you're getting more and more tangled up. And with time and experience and weariness and, you know, I mean, that's part of what happens in Sesshin. It's just like you just can't keep it up anymore, right? You're just being ground down. It's hard to keep all that stuff going, right? You're just down to the essentials, down to the bare elements, right? Good. So we didn't even get into, I wanted to go through the just a little bit about the four foundations, but we've been speaking about it in more general terms, but if you aren't familiar with those, with that sutra, I would really encourage you to do that. There are a number of books on them. I mean, they're in these texts, you know. And in fact, Pia Dasi has, I don't know if it's the whole sutra, but he has the Satipatthana in here.
It's the short version.
And there are now, I think, I'm sort of working out the Angos for the next, for this year, but I think it would be good to have a whole Ango just on mindfulness so we can spend more time with this. But there are a number of books out on it that are, you really need, you know, books of commentaries to flesh out the density of the sutra, because the Buddha's just giving you the blood of it, right? He's just giving you the sort of concentration, the concentrated essence of it, and so that needs to get picked apart a little bit and explained, and so that's why the commentaries are important. So I encourage you to do that. I mean, as Dharma practitioners, we should all be familiar with this teaching. You know, it's not, we don't take it up in exactly that way. We don't teach it in exactly that way in our own, you know, teaching of Zazen and presentation of it, but it's there, right? It's there. I mean, if you think about your own experience of Zazen in terms of body, breath, feelings, sensations, emotions, mind objects, if any of those are being left out, or any of those are not part of your, you know, in your field of awareness, of mindfulness, something's being left out. Okay, so let's end there. And we'll come back a couple weeks, I think, not too far, and we'll do the last one on right concentration. Okay, so... somebody like to leave?
Thanks for listening. Do you have physical challenges to visiting Zen Mountain Monastery or Fire Lotus Temple? The Diamond Net is a group of Mountains and Rivers Order students who are available to support your practice. We provide Dharma and other support to Sangha members facing life challenges such as illness or mobility issues. If you would like to visit the monastery or the Zen Center but need some physical help, someone from the Diamond Net can assist you. For information, email diamondnet@mro.org or visit our webpage at zmm.org and look under the Programs menu.